Hi, this is Nivi from Venture Hacks, and I'm here with Chris Dixon, who I think is in New York, Mark Suster, who I think is in LA, and Naval Ravikant, who's in San Francisco with me. And the subject today is VC signaling and seed rounds, and we're going to use that as a jumping off point to branch into other aspects of VC involvement in seed rounds. So before we get into it, why don't we just go around and you guys can give us each your 140 character bio. We'll start off with Chris, then Mark, then Naval.
Okay, sure. So way back I was a computer programmer, and then I started a couple of companies. My last company was called SiteAdvisor, which was acquired by McAfee. My current company is called Hunch, which I co-founded with my SiteAdvisor co-founder and Katarina Fake from Flickr. And then on the side, I am an angel investor. I was a personal angel investor. Now I do it through a fund that I co-founded called Founder Collective.
That sounded like the Facebook edition rather than the Twitter edition.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm just teasing. This is Mark Suster, and I'll give the Facebook edition as well. I also started as a developer, for what it's worth. And I built, founded and was CEO of two companies, both in the document management space. The first I built in Europe, ended up selling to a French publicly traded company called the Sword Group. The second I built in Silicon Valley, also a document management company called Coral. I sold that to Salesforce.com, where I became VP product management. And for my sins, I have joined the dark side as a full-time gig, working for GRP Partners, who funded both of my companies based in sunny Los Angeles. We are the largest venture capital firm in Southern California.
Great. So this is Naval, and I'll give the LinkedIn edition, which will ramble on for about 10 minutes. So I'm a startup guy as well, started out as a developer, co-founded Opinions, where I was the founding CEO. Company went public as part of Shopping.com, and it was eventually acquired by eBay, started Vast.com, which is a large classified ad network that powers Kelly Blue Book, AOL, USAA, and some other very large sites, and have also started Venture Hacks with Nivi, where I'm a co-author and helped create Venture Hacks and AngelList. These days, I'm angel investing as well. So I was an early investor in Twitter, Social Gold, PlanCast most recently, and a whole bunch of others.
So we've, if I've got this right, we've got Chris Dixon, who is at what I would call a seed stage fund, or what some people call a super angel fund. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, just to clarify, that's really a side thing for me. I mean, I'm full-time at Hunch, but...
Right, and also a practicing entrepreneur at Hunch. And then we got Mark Suster, who is a full-time VC at GRP, which is a multi-stage fund, and he's a former serial entrepreneur. So you guys do seed rounds, A rounds, all the way through up to what?
And we do B and C rounds as well.
Okay. And then Naval, who is represents himself mostly as an angel investor. People know him as Naval, but he's investing other people's money. He has a fund. Is that right, Naval?
Yeah, I'm investing my money and other people's money out of a fund.
Right. Okay, great. So why don't we start off with just some definitions, if that's cool. One thing I'd like to hear, and I'm sure our audience would like to hear, is what are the different types of funds that are doing seed investing right now? What sizes are they? What are the relevant attributes that distinguish these funds? And maybe I'll throw it out to Mark to start the conversation.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Listen, the definition of what a seed investment in has really blurred. Historically, money was raised by what they call the three F's, friends, family, and fools. And that typically was, you know, your immediate group of people that you knew. And then people graduated into an angel round, which might have been prominent people from the community who had built tech firms in the past. And those rounds historically were, call it, 150 to 250K. A lot of professional angel groups or super angel groups have been founded. And there's also just a lot more wealth these days of people who created and sold tech businesses and want to do angel investing. So they're moving up the stack and doing 750K investments. Traditional seed round, I would call somewhere between $500,000 to $1 million, and there are seed stage funds that do that. And then the next thing you graduate into would be a venture capital round. Venture capital rounds tend to be, I don't know why, but they tend to go in letters. An A round tends to be your first round of investment. That usually is somewhere in the neighborhood. And I'm going to leave out outliers, outliers being people who are superstars and have created companies and can raise at 90 pre on their first deal. But a traditional first investment will be $2 to $3 million from a venture capitalist. And that might creep up to $5 million if it's a big team and a big idea and if a lot of progress had been made previously. And a B round will typically be in the 5 to 7 range, but can be 8 to 10, and I'll stop talking there.
Naval, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, my definition is not so much around the cash, because the amount of cash that these different funds put in is squishy. It depends on the supply of cash flowing through the system. So right now, with the NASDAQ being up again recently and there having been some recent exits, there's a lot more angels out there investing. And so even the definition of a seed round, as Mark put it, has gone to 500K to a million. But even a year and a half ago, seed rounds were smaller than that. They might be 250 to 750 or maybe even under 500. So the cash definition moves around based on the environment. What doesn't change is kind of the attitude, philosophy, and investment style. Generally, in a seed out of a seed round investor or a seed fund, you can get a decision out of one or two meetings and without extensive due diligence and, you know, kind of the multi-month get-to-know-you process. You also don't get onerous control terms. So most seed investors these days do not take a board seat. And if they do, it'll expire at the A round. And the term sheets and the documents are usually on one of the standardized forms or it's a one- or two-page term sheet kind of thing.
Great. Chris?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, what else could I say? Often the angel rounds will be, like, I do a lot of convertible notes with caps on them. Should I define that, or is that something your listeners would know? But so the type of security will vary often, seed rounds versus proper venture rounds.
That's a good point, Chris. That goes hand in hand with the lower control issue.
Yeah, and it's also like legal fees. So like you can do a convert with a cap kind of gives the seed investors the economics of setting a valuation without the control rights, which they tend not to care as much about, but doing it in a less expensive way. So, you know, you could do that with maybe $5,000 or something as opposed to $20,000 for an equity financing. When you're doing $500,000 round, that's meaningful. So
the convertible notes type structure has an effect where it actually gives the seed entrepreneur a lot more flexibility. They can kind of run the business however they want. They don't have to have board meetings. They don't have to check in. They could even add a co-founder and dilute another 20-30%. The investor is less likely to care because they're protected against that by the conversion cap.
Yeah, I think it's a decent structure, actually, because it gives you – I mean, obviously, I like it to have a – you know, as an investor, I want it to have a cap that, you know, allows for some reasonable upside if things are going well and allows you to – as an investor, feel an incentive to go help the entrepreneur raise a higher priced A round. But it also, as you said, gives you flexibility because it's sort of baked in there that it's like, so the way it works is either, you know, you get the investor gets the better of, let's say, a 20% discount or let's say a $4 million valuation. So, you know, it's like if you do it the next round at $3 million, you still get a discount and it's not sort of seen as kind of a quote down round. I mean, it's not the greatest thing optically, but it's not. So it kind of, yeah, you're right. It kind of gives more flexibility. It just kind of, it defers a lot of these sorts of, you know, voting rights and all this other kind of stuff, which just seems like excessive at this early stage to the equity round.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. And so let's go on to the next question. And let me throw in what I see before we go to the next question. The cast of characters that I see entrepreneurs running into, and tell me if I'm right or wrong, is basically they run into an angel investing his own money, or it's an angel investing other people's money, like Naval, who markets himself as an angel, or say Jeff Clavier. They run into seed stage funds, like First Round Capital or Founder Collective, and they run into multi-stage funds like GRP. And am I missing anything in that list of folks that you'll run into when you raise a seed round?
I mean, there's certain outliers, like you know, BetaWorks, who I'm buddies with in New York, they are actually like a C corp, and they're kind of really funky, but in terms of structure. But I think that's what you've just described is generally the case, I'd say.
Okay, great. So next question is, what exactly is VC signaling? And I'm going to throw it out to Naval. Before I do, maybe I'm just going to propose a definition. So I'm going to throw this out. VC signaling is when a firm that is known to a prospective investor to invest in subsequent financings and has knowledge of the company says that they're not going to reinvest in the next round, or says they are going to reinvest in the round, or says they're going to do their pro rata, but it's basically what they say they're going to do in the round. What do you think about that, Naval?
Yeah, I would actually use a slightly broader definition. I would say that VC signaling is when insiders, through their actions, convey information that is more powerful than what is being conveyed through words.
Okay, so what's an insider?
Insider is any investor who's an insider. And it's more of an issue with VCs because VCs have more capital, and they tend to put in more diligence, and they tend to participate in future rounds. So their signaling effect is more powerful than angel signaling.
And what are the typical actions?
Can I broaden the definition? I'm sorry. Can I broaden the definition?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Further. I don't think it's prohibited to just people who made the investment.
That's true. Yeah. It's the actions of insiders who may have more knowledge than you.
And,
well, it's also like it could be the fact that, you know, I think what Mark is saying, I agree with. It can be the fact that, there's some entrepreneur was an EIR at Sequoia, and now they're going out and raising money, and everyone's like, why the hell didn't Sequoia invest? And Sequoia might not
exactly be
an investor. But it's kind of like, because the basic idea is, especially in the seed stage round, you have so little other information to go on. You don't have revenues, you don't have a product in the market, you know, you don't have all these other, so the signaling happens in every market, including the public markets.
Yep.
You know, the fact that some smart hedge fund took a position can have an effect on other investors.
I think signaling can be as much about what insiders do in your fund as what people did not invest in your company. The classic case I like to give of signaling is, you know, you worked for somebody, you were VP of whatever, there was a CEO, they got a huge exit, they sold for $400 million, they put $70 million in their pocket, and you have a list of angels, let's say it's five prominent people from your community, and that CEO who you reported to did not invest.
Yeah,
and if they're known to do angel investments, you know, like it or not, it's a signal.
So maybe the broadest definition would just be that it is the public actions of people who have information that you do not have.
Yes.
Often it's not even public. It's just sort of back channel, like, or you know, the lack of action, for example, is
Right. The action or lack of action of people who have other information.
It just comes down to the reason it's so important in seed rounds, and I don't think I've, like, ever, one of the reasons I like to blog about this topic is I think it's not at all obvious to entrepreneurs who haven't done investing, because I think when you're an entrepreneur, right, you kind of think like, oh, these investors will, that you go in, they analyze your business, they're really super smart and rational, and you kind of maybe give them more credit than they deserve, and I'm including myself in this category, when in fact, a lot of it's like, you know, how you actually make these decisions, things are moving very quickly, you know, it's referred by a really trusted source. You know, their boss, who is a great guy, is investing, and a bunch of other interesting people are investing, and, you know, you don't have that much more information in a lot of these seed investments.
You know, Nivi, I read on Venture Hacks the other day, you know, you talked about this, you called it social proof, and I even tried that on This Week in Venture Capital with Jason Calacanis, and he didn't like the term. I kind of like it, social proof. You know, if I'm looking at doing an angel deal and four people that I know have already done it, there's a certain short-circuiting that happens, almost like, rightly or wrongly, by the way, but almost like, you know, if you're hiring somebody and you know they were at Google or McKinsey or went to Harvard Business School or whatever, there's a certain signal implied in that.
Well, social proof is completely rational, and it's employed more in markets where each entity has a little piece of the information. So if you look in the public markets, there's a form of social proof going on with the pricing. Many different people are making the decision, and all of their collective information is determining the price of the security. The difference is in the public market that those decisions are made, and then everyone kind of moves at the same time. The difference in private investing is that people move in series. So I commit to the round before Chris commits, and he commits before Mark commits, and so on. So that signal propagates in a way that we can cumulatively add the information value and get the deal done. So the herd mentality is not irrational. It just emerges from the fact that private rounds close in series, whereas public rounds close in parallel.
Great. So that segues into the next question, which I'll throw out to Chris. Is we talked about insiders taking actions, or we're talking about a signal. How exactly is that signal transmitted? Is it go from VC to VC, VC to entrepreneur to VC? Is it over email? Do VCs call each other on the phone as soon as they see a company? Do they call the last round investors or anyone else who might have inside information? Should I assume every prospective investor I talk to automatically emails my existing investors? I'll throw it out to Chris.
I mean, so the first thing is that this business of seed investing and, frankly, early stage entrepreneurship is so much about getting in good information, and almost all that information, unfortunately, is not published. And hence, any entrepreneur or early stage or mid stage investor, any investor for that matter, you're constantly talking to people, right? It's just part of your job. I'm sure Mark will say that as well, right? It's
like, yep.
It happens through all different forms. But in particular, I'll just give you a simple example. So this is what prompted me to write, I think, a post last year about, I think it was titled Don't Take Seed Money from Big Investors or something. It was a kid came into my office and he said, I want to raise a follow-on round. I raised a round earlier. And the prior round was one that was, let's say, $100,000 done by a big VC and $300,000 done by a bunch of angels. So it was a $400,000 round, right? And I had seen him 6 months before. I knew that this big VC had invested. And he was raising more money. And so he's like, I want to raise more money. And so the first question I ask, and the first question every investor is going to ask, is what is the big VC doing? Are they doing so at that point, the big VC has sort of like, let's say roughly three things they'll typically do. They'll be doing like leading the round, meaning they're doing, you know, 500 to a million or 2 million or 3 million. They're doing pro rata, which says they kind of like it, but they're continuing it. Or they're doing nothing, which says basically they hate it. Right. And so he's like, oh, they're doing nothing. They don't want to participate in the round. And so what do I think? I think, okay, so these are the guys, these are smart money, you know, professional investors who've been tracking this guy very closely for the last 9 months. I was just like very blunt to the guys. I was like, look, it's going to be hard for me to invest. And quite frankly, I don't think anyone's going to invest in you now because you're damaged goods in the eyes of the investment community. It's totally unfair. You may have a great company, but that's just the way it is. And 6 months later, he shut down and sent me an email saying, unfortunately, you're right. No one would talk because of that action of the big VC. And, you know, And that after I got that email, I wrote that blog post. So I just think it's, you know, the sad thing is that, you know, there's these sort of 10%, let's say 5% and 10% of the time the company's hitting out of the park and it doesn't matter what the signaling is. And the other 10% of the time, let's say the company's a disaster and you should just shut down anyways. But I would say 80% of the time, things are kind of going mediocrely and, you know, they're going okay. And the signaling actually can kill killed a reasonably good company. And the big VC did it to get so they would get an option on the later round. So it was completely sort of self-interested on their side, and they killed a company, and they didn't think twice about it. I think it's really, really sketchy, and that's why I wrote about it, and that's why I kind of consistently it's one of my themes on my blog.
Hey, Mark, do you want to follow up, but without necessarily getting into the whole take seed cash from VCs or not, because we'll get to that. I'd like to get into a little bit more about different types of signaling that occurs in addition to the ones Chris described?
Sure. just talking more broadly about signaling and picking up on some of the things that were said, all VCs talk to each other. You can try to, and seed investors too, and you can try to keep them apart, but they're all really poorly behaved. And you just have to realize that. I'll give you an example. When I was fundraising for my second company, Salesforce was already a major client of mine. And I said to people during the process, I said, if you become interested and we're interested in you at the right time, I'll set you up to call whoever you want. You can validate at any level in Salesforce. Please just don't call without my consent. Three VCs in Silicon Valley called Mark Benioff, the CEO, and asked about us. And one called the other co-founder who was the CTO.
And did they just call him like right after the meeting, essentially?
I don't know, within a week. And the other called Parker Harris, the CTO. And I had expressly asked them not to. And each time Mark Benioff would send it down to the head of corporate development who was managing the relationship with me, and not in a flattering way, like, why are these guys bugging me, and who the hell are these Coral guys? And every time just shit rolls downhill and would roll down to me, and I found it really irritating, which is why I wrote blog posts about this stuff publicly, why I tell people it's not a smart idea to go out and cast a really wide net. Everybody talks to everybody. Everybody makes calls they say they're not going to. And because it's such an insular community, if five or six people passed, everyone will hear. And venture capitalists and seed stage investors, and it's an industry filled with lemmings. So if you hear five or six people pass, you're predisposed not to like it. And that's unfortunate, but it's reality. So you have to be very careful. But to answer your question to me about other types of signaling,
I actually think that was a great example. And do you mind if we pass it on to Naval?
Oh, yeah, no,
yeah,
go on.
Sorry, there's a plane flying over here.
Yeah,
so
sorry.
I'm waiting for that to pass before I talk. Yeah, so I got a lot of thoughts, not in any discrete order, but going back to what Chris Dixon was talking about, making some very good points, I would say that there's basically five levels of signals that can get sent, all the way from an insider trying to do the whole round, which is something Sequoia does very often, which sends a hugely positive signal. Somewhere in the middle is doing a little bit more than your pro rata. The pro rata is the point of indifference, which is where the entrepreneur is indifferent to the VC, the VC is indifferent to future VCs coming in. If you do more than your pro rata, you're signaling that the valuation is low, you want to own more, and so other investors want to come in, but now you're at odds with the entrepreneur. If you do less than your pro rata, you're signaling you don't really believe in this valuation, and so new investors are less likely to come in. And of course, if you pass altogether, as in the example that Chris gave, then you're sending a very bad signal, saying that you don't believe in the company at all. And so this, obviously, this is a very old problem. So the old VC community had established a method of working through this, which was that they only worked with other investors they liked, and it was considered that a supportive investor would do their pro rata, no more, no less, so that they were not at odds with the entrepreneur or with a subsequent investor. And it was just expected that if a deal came to you, it would come to you through another VC, and of course that VC was doing their pro rata. And if that VC wasn't doing their pro rata, they shouldn't even be sending you the deal. And of course, they shouldn't be doing more than their pro rata, because then they're at odds with the entrepreneur. And this was considered the definition of a supportive investor. And I think that it has broken down, and it has broken down for two reasons. One is you have a lot of players who are now getting in at the seed stage or the A stage who have no intention of following on later or are inconsistent in their actions. And it's also breaking down because you have VCs who are reaching down to the seed level. And they have no intention of following back up onto the A level. So the pro rata supportive investor definition was a stable configuration that kept the VC industry past the signaling problem, or kept the signaling problem out for decades. And I think it's just broken down now because so many more of the deals now are seed deals, and everybody wants
to. I would argue, Naval, that it still works that way, Series A and later.
Yes. You're right. It's a seed issue.
I think the fundamental problem here, right, like going backwards, is that the VC, basically going, you have to go back and trace it to the LP community, but basically the VC world got way too big. The good funds, you know, benchmark was 85 million in 96,
right.
Now it's 400 million. Well, good funds got really big, and then a whole bunch of bad funds were created. Because there was excess appetite for LPs. So you just
right.
had this
and on top of it, it became so cheap to start a company.
Exactly. So you had this divergence of trends. And so this thing still functions sort of normally at the later stages when you're still putting in $10 million and there is this kind of collegiality or something. But there's this sort of confusion with the big VCs of how to play in the seed rounds. And so you're right. Like, that's in total turmoil right now. There's new people like us entering, et cetera. And I think you know, good firms like Marks and, let's say, you know, Fred Wilson, other people who are kind of determining new norms for how VCs kind of go into this earlier stage. And I think there's sort of become emerging to be a right and a wrong way.
So the clean way out of this is if people establish a norm and stick to it. So, for example, a seed fund that says we never do any investment after the seed stage. We don't do pro rata. We don't follow on. Or it could be even a VC fund who's investing in seed and they say, if we invest seed, we've bought our fill, and we always do pro rata, or we never do pro rata, or we always do super pro rata, right? But you have to establish a rule and stick to it, otherwise you're signaling. And even the people who establish...
The only people who can really establish that rule, though, are smaller funds, because the bigger funds, the business isn't to be in...
Okay,
all right.
The temptation is very strong when you see a hot company growing up, that even for a seed fund, you want to put more in. Okay, so that was great. And on that point, I'm going to throw the next one out to Mark. Do you guys have a policy at GRP, or do you want to talk about other folks that may or may not have a policy? And to set the stage, you guys don't really do a lot of willy-nilly seed stage investing as options. You don't invest $100K in 15 different companies. You guys do focused seed investing. Is that right?
Yes. I think the velocity of how many deals you do matters. If you do 30 investments as an individual partner, and let's just be honest, if you do 15 investments in a two-year period of time in seed stage type deals at the same time while you're doing later stage investments, it's an option value to you. You just can't track that many companies. And you can't substantively help them. There are people who do high volume and have set up different kinds of VC models to handle that kind of volume, but the traditional VC cannot. And so we do a low volume of seed stage. And for me, it's often because the entrepreneur doesn't want to raise as much capital, and it's an earlier stage business that hasn't yet determined product market fit. And we're willing to take that risk for the right investor. I think the world breaks down into three buckets. And I've talked to Fred and Brad and everybody about this. And I think everyone kind of, the good guys, if I call them, sort of all agree. A, and by the way, Chris already went through these, but A is the company just isn't performing. It's not doing well. And no investor, whether it's an angel, a seed, an A round, anyone, if you're not doing well, no one's going to guarantee your next round, right? So there are some that if you end up doing 10 seed stage deals, there could be two of those that you just shut down and they just don't even get another penny. The opposite case is the ones that are doing tremendously well. I tell these seed companies the same thing. Number one, if you want GRP to price the round and lead the round, I am, as Brad Feld calls it, syndicate agnostic. I am willing to write the next check, and I'm willing to set price, and I'm willing to take the whole thing if you want. I'm willing to take half of it if you want. If you prefer to shop the deal and you're doing well and you want to go to Silicon Valley and see the highest price you can get, you can tell them I'll take half the round. And if they won't let me take half the round, I guess I'll be forced to take pro rata. But it's my job to convince the entrepreneur that I add enough value to want me to either lead the round or do half, and B, that I've offered a fair price, that it's not worth both the time investment as well as all the information leak and signaling that happens with the fundraising. And I have actually done that before. But the more troubling scenario is scenario B. And unfortunately, that happened. My percentage was 70% of the time. Chris said 80, but let's call it somewhere between 65 to 80% of the time where you're doing okay. It's not clear that you're going to be amazing, but you're not underperforming, but it's just okay. And that's the overwhelming majority of companies. And what we said at GRP when we set up this fund is, so we set up $7.5 million. $5 million is for primary investment. $2.5 million, and that's just our seed program. $2.5 million is for follow-ons for these B scenarios. Because if it's a good scenario and it's doing well, that comes from the bigger fund where we're leading the round. And what's important is there are times where you just have to do an extra $500,000 that'll buy them an extra 9 to 12 months to get more proof points. But when we write that check, we will say, and we haven't had to write one yet, but when we write that check, we will say, listen, this may be the last check you get from us unless we see positive performance, and we're hoping we will. And so you either are going to want to perform better, or you may start trying to think over the next 18 months about parking this asset somewhere, or about getting the ramen profitability so that you preserve your options. But as a VC fund, you can't guarantee that you're just going to follow every single investment.
Right, but the problem emerges, Mark, because you are funding the winners with insider rounds, or you're making them those big offers. So all the guys who are doing okay that you're not making those offers to, they suddenly have the stench of failure about
them.
Listen,
I accept your argument in theory, but then there's life. And the reality is that these are real markets. Just because they're private doesn't mean they're not real markets. These are real markets. And I can't imagine any fund is going to set up and say, we're going to have 100% rule, no way, no how, are we ever going to lead and pick winners and, whatever. It just isn't going to happen. And so let's take some of the early stage funds that usually didn't do follow-on rounds. Well, you know, I heard through the grapevine that out of their 40 investment, they did do two or three follow-on rounds. So either you're absolutely 100% religiously in your conviction, never going to do it, or even if you do one or two, it's a signal. We tell people up front, before we do the investment, our kind of ABC mentality, and by the way, just because you're a B does not mean that you're not going to succeed. What it means is you might need an extra year to be able to get to the point. And because we write the check internally and we give you that extra year, it just may be there is no signal in the market. Nobody ever knows that, because a year from now, either you sold the company, you got to ramen profitability, or now you're ready to do a proper round and now we're really excited and ready to invest, or you shut down.
Okay, thanks, Mark. That was great. So I'll go to Val and Chris just to get a quick reply to either to anything Mark said, and then we'll go on to the next question. Naval?
I think there is a signal buried in that whole transaction, and Mark argues it very eloquently. But if he's funding 2 out of 10 companies with an insider round, and then he's bridging a bunch, and then he's passing on a bunch, he's sending signals. And I don't disagree that other people don't send signals either. And it's at varying degrees, right? So if Ron Conway doesn't invest in your follow-on round, it doesn't mean anything, right? Whereas if Sequoia did your seed deal, and then they have an option on the follow-on round, and they decline that option, that signals something.
But hold on, so Naval. Everyone knows that Ron has an A-list and a B-list, right? Everybody knows that.
If I could just defend Mark here for a minute. I think there's a massive – every action has signaling, there's no question. But there's a massive, massive difference between a big fund like Mark's doing real diligence, putting in meaningful money like 500 grand or 2 million or something, and having a – true intention to, you know, create a great company and follow on and help them and work with them, versus what I think there are people we all know of who are going around and, like, literally after a 20-minute conversation at a conference, will write a 50 grand check, never speak to the entrepreneur again until they are raising more money, and then try to exercise an option. There's just a massive, massive difference between the two.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we should acknowledge that, and I think it's important, because I think what Mark's fund is doing is a very sort of ethical and proper response. I mean, I'm not, you know, there's always some signaling, et cetera, but, like, it's an attempt for a big firm to move down market. And I always judge these things. In the end of the day, I'm saying, is this person in the end of the day creating more great companies, or are they just sort of trying to steal pieces of existing companies? And I think that practice is the former and the better practice, and is actually, like, programs like Y Combinator is really sort of increasing net innovation in the world, and that's a good thing, versus these kind of bad guys who are going around and just trying to kind of steal a piece of someone else's innovation. And so I just think we should, that is a big difference. And I think maybe, like, in my blog about this, sometimes it's not, you know, sometimes the message is sort of taken to be like all big firms shouldn't be doing seed investments, but
no, I think we could divide the world into good and evil, and coincidentally, the evil guys always happen to be the ones who aren't on the line, right?
Like, how much time do they spend is a critical thing. Like, did they do diligence? Like, are they continuing to follow up? You know, like, if a guy meets you at a conference, I mean, this literally happened last week. I met these guys, and they met somebody at a conference from a big VC, and in 20 minutes, he said, "I'll write a 50 grand check." Okay, like, that is clearly an option, right? And that's just ridiculous. I mean, because it's going to just screw up the company. It's, you know, like, and Mark knows what I'm talking about. We all know what I'm talking about.
I'm with you 100%.
I think. Okay. Next question.
I was going to say last thing that leads to at least one distinction, which is don't give somebody a contractual option to.
Well, that's the thing I'm saying, though. Of course, you don't give them contractual options, but I'm saying that some of these firms, just even writing a 50 grand check, gives them sort of an effective, not a completely effective, but a somewhat of an effective option just to the signaling value. That was sort of one.
Okay.
Of my,
thank you, Chris and Naval and Mark. So next question. Let's say I've actually taken VC cash in my seed round, and I'm in.
Can I just say one thing? It's not just cash. I think if you take office space, I think if you take anything that
associates
yourself with a VC, so, and even if it's called something like Candylandville or something, and it's not called big VC name or whatever, it still has that effect. So, like, I think that's
important.
Because what happens?
Okay.
Every time the VCs, like people like us, call them out, they come up with another new, more obfuscated way to do the same thing. And we're seeing another round of that right now, I think. And it's just the
and
same
it,
thing.
It is.
Hey, okay. Come on. I'm going to cut all you guys off. No more. And we'll get back to that point, Chris, obfuscation. Let's talk about the case where I've taken cash from a VC. We don't need to talk about whether I was an EIR there or I took office space there. But let's talk about the case where I took cash from a VC. And I'm in the middling case where maybe they're not being too helpful with the financing, or I'm in the bad case where they're not interested in investing at all. What do I do other than shut down the company? What's my way out of it? How do I talk my way out of it, for example, when I'm talking to new prospective investors? And I think it's Naval's turn to start.
Sure. That's a really tough situation where your VC is not willing to do their pro rata. And it's a fund that has a habit and a history and a size commensurate with they're normally doing pro ratas. In that case, if it truly is an exceptional case, for example, they've decided to exit this section of the market, or they're shutting down the fund, or the partner who sponsored the deal is gone, then you want to be very upfront about that with prospective investors, and you want to have that checkout and a reference if they call your original investor. The second case is you could have such a hot deal that it doesn't matter. You could just have so much traction that people will overlook that. But if you don't have the incredible traction, or if you don't have a really good and exceptional reason that can be checked out with your investor, then I think you have the stench of death about you, and you're going to have a very hard time raising money. It is the exact situation that Chris described at the opening of this conversation.
But still, how can I talk my way out of it?
I mean, examples would be the partner's gone, they're no longer in the space, their fund is shutting down, they're low on cash, we didn't get along with, I mean, you could even try and say stuff like, we pissed them off, we got into a fight, they just don't like us, but here, look at our great product, look at our great traction. But these are difficult situations. There's no magic bullet answer. They're highly contextual, difficult situations.
Got it. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing, I mean, it's really, really tough, but I think you try to do things that send opposite signals. So, you know, obviously making progress in the core business is the number one thing. But aside from that, let's say you're internet security, you know, you're a security company, like technology information security, you go and find five luminaries in the business that say you've done the most amazing thing in the world, and maybe that'll counteract the VC's negativity. You know, I mean, so there's other things you can do to kind of build up the story so that it sort of outweighs this sort of strong negative thing. Obviously, the best thing of all is revenue and profits and things, but, you know, I'm assuming you're too early stage. But I've seen it be only fatal so far in my experience. It's pretty much
100%
fatality rate in my experience.
I want to disagree with your definition, because you said the middling case, or the case of they're not going to support you at all. In the middling case, I'll make the very clear argument that I think better VCs will bridge you. And, you know, so if I've written a $500,000 check and I think you're doing okay tracking but not killing it, I might do another $500,000 investment in your company to give you equally as long as the first time to prove yourself. And nobody knows about that. And I just want to make that clear. So what I think I'm talking about is a case where the VC doesn't support you at all. And my view is, and I always tell this to people, deal with the elephant in the room. Don't try to pretend like it isn't there. There's an LA-based company that raised money from a very prominent VC, and those guys got into a drag-out fight. I talked to the VC, and the VC doesn't say good things about the entrepreneurs. But the entrepreneurs got to me first, and they said, we took money from this VC. Here's the partner we dealt with. He's a complete dick. Here's what he did. Here's why we were unhappy. Here's why they don't like us. And they were also very honest. Here are the mistakes we made in the last year, and why we haven't performed. Here's what our new strategy is, et cetera. And I just think you got to deal with the elephant in the room. It's better than hiding it, because I think the information will come out anyways.
Okay, great. So next question is going to be, what if a VC invests in your seed round? Let's say they don't do it as an option, but they do it as like it's a focused investment in your seed round, but they don't own much of your company. Let's call it under 15% and maybe closer to 10. Does that matter? And do they end up fighting against your valuation in the next round? Or, as some people argue, can they actually afford to pay more in the next round because they can dollar cost average their purchase in the new round? So I think we're up for Chris to start. Is that right?
So you're saying if they have under their target percentage?
Yeah, the question wasn't very clear. So let's say a VC does a focused investment in your seed round. They own, say, 10 to 15% of the company, but not 20 to 30. Do they end up fighting against your valuation in the next round because they are trying to increase their percentage ownership? Or, as like some folks argue, can they actually afford to pay more than outside investors in the next round because they can dollar cost average their investment?
Well, I think these things vary so much. I mean, I'm watching a case situation right now where precisely like the VC put in less than his target amount. Like every VC seem to have these different sort of magic amounts they want to own, 15%, 20%. But in reality, with the hot company, they'll all own far less. But in this case, I don't believe in the latter thing. Like the insider. Probably is not going to be the highest, if it's a good company, willingness, you know, have the highest willingness to pay in terms of valuation. But, this is a really hard one. It just varies so much. It's just like, if they love the company, they'll probably want to pay up and do a preemptive round. I mean, you know, and then the company has to decide, do they want to go out and spend the time and spread all this information about their company around, try to get a market price, you know. Like I often counsel that they should talk to one or two people, not 20, and get some sense of the market and then give their favorite one a 25% discount or something. But, you know.
Great. Mark?
Number one, I don't think investment is that rational. I don't think people sit around and say, what price do we pay? Will we cost average up? Will we do this? Will we do that? It's very emotional. It shouldn't be, maybe. It is some amount of rationality in terms of, you know, what do we think the exit price is? Our investment price, do we think we're going to get a good multiple on our investment? But the reality is that an investor, whether they own 8% of your company now and they're trying to decide if they want to re-up in the next round and what price they'll pay what the market will bear if they feel you're a hot company.
Yeah, but will they signal against you if they're trying to own more than they own right now?
That's a signal in your favor.
I don't believe so. I don't believe.
Oh, you're saying, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't believe an inside investor will work hard to stop you from raising at a high price if you can.
I've had the situation many times as an entrepreneur where you go out and everyone's like, they're like, am I a stalking horse? Like, why are you talking to me when you have, you know, Bessemer, this billion-dollar fund, as a seed investor? Am I just being used as a stalking horse to set the price? And then you get in this really weird situation, right?
I completely agree with you. And I tell it to people all the time. And I even say the same about strategic investors, because if they're used and you try to sell to one of their competitors, it's the same signal, right? That's why for me, when I make the investment, and I've said to my companies, if you want to go shop at a higher price, when you're shopping, tell them I'll take half the round.
What I do is I force my investors to kind of give me like a decision ahead of time and then like a no action letter so that I can affect, not literally, but like, so I can know like if I'm going out and telling them they're not a stalking horse, that they're really not a stalking horse. Otherwise, I was like a total jerk.
Okay.
Yeah, but by the way, just a thought. We may want to go back up to a level of greater simplicity, because we are talking about things that are very sophisticated and very advanced, and we understand them because we're all entrepreneurs and we're investors, but I would guess that to the average Venture Hacks reader, this is going straight over their heads.
Maybe not. I mean, I'm glad to talk about some simple issues if there are some that you think we're missing.
No, I don't have any offhand.
Okay, it's that's fine.
We're getting very detailed.
Very detailed is the name of the game at Venture Hacks, so I don't care. All right. Naval, did you have anything to say about VCs not owning enough in the seed round?
Yeah, I think if you have like a very large fund and they bought, you know, a very small percentage of the seed round, then you can expect that they are going to try and up their ownership next round. They're not going to do it by sending negative signals out into the marketplace to try and keep your valuation down or anything. Usually the tactic is just they'll propose an insider round. They'll just say, hey, this is preemptive. Before you go talking to everybody else, why don't you take this? And these days, a savvy entrepreneur will figure out what the right answer for preemptive is. You know, they'll talk to a few friends, they'll read up on TechCrunch, and they'll make their decision about what's truly preemptive or not. So I've seen some preemptive financing done recently. by VCs who put a little bit in the seed round and then they want to do the whole Series A. And generally, I'd say they're at or about market, or maybe even higher.
Got it. Okay, good. I think we have time for two more questions. First one is going to be, what are the benefits of taking VC cash in a seed round? One, and at the same time, let's talk about why maybe this is more about the integrity and the policies of the firm than taking VC cash from taking seed cash from a VC firm, yes or no? Did that make sense?
No.
Mark,
yeah.
Do you mind if I start with that one?
Mark understands it, and I'm going to throw it out to him anyway.
Okay. Listen, I think, and I've tried to argue, that the most important decision when you're raising money is the people you're raising money from, knowing their background, doing your due diligence, talking to everybody who's ever taken money from, or not everybody, but enough of a sample pool of people who've taken money from them, find out about their reputation, and whether you're raising money from angel, seed, VCs, that matters to me more than signaling. I think the world is a signal. Everything that happens is a signal. You're an EIR, it's a signal. Your boss, who was you reported to at Yahoo, is now a VC, isn't investing, that's a signal. Shouldn't be, but it is. The world is a signal. So knowing who you take money from whom you take money, is really important. And the plus side of venture capital, and by the way, I think very few venture capitalists make good seed investors, very, very few. I would include True Ventures, First Round Capital, Founder Group, Union Square. I think I do a reasonable job of it at GRP, but very few actually do. But the benefit if you do is if you raise $750,000 and you end up in the 70% case, which is you're doing okay but not amazing, it is far easier to get a $500,000 extension, $750,000 extension with relatively painless work to get a bridge note from that VC investor than it is to go out to eight different angels and try to get checks for $70,000 each. Now, the reason is a lot of the signal for angel investors on whether or not they should continue funding you, I think, is if you've gone out and done all the VC rounds and no one was interested, then that's a signal to them that it's going to be hard to get finance through to the next round. So I think there are some positives, there are some negatives. It all comes down to the individual.
Thanks. Naval?
Yeah, I think Mark made a really good point at the beginning of that, which I would accentuate, which is you can always break up with your co-founder if they're not working out. You can fire your customer if they're a pain. You can break off a deal with a partner. You can get rid of an employee, but you can't divorce your investor. You're stuck. And I've seen companies show up that hate their investor and say, can you buy my investor out? And it's just such a huge disaster that those companies never make it. So that is paramount. It's job one. And in terms of what Mark was saying about the bridge, I had a real-life experience with that recently where a company that was doing okay ran out of cash, and there were two of us who had seed funds, so you know we had quite a bit of money, relative to the other 10 investors who were all individuals. Company needed a bridge, and the other seed fund guy and I had to step up and do it. And luckily, the company is doing well now, but none of the individuals could or wanted to or felt kind of the need to step up. And they're good guys, but it's just not their model. So if you feel like your company may need a bridge or it may need to continue onward, that's a good reason to get a larger fund involved. And even in my case, you know, I'm a small seed fund, so it was a tough decision for me, whereas I think for a fund like Mark's, they might, if they like the company, they might just write a $200,000 extension check without thinking twice.
Thanks. And Chris, can you do me a favor and just move a little closer to the Polycom or whatever you're using? And it's your turn.
Okay. I mean, I think I just I completely agree with Mark. It's all about people. I guess just what concerns me right now is I see a lot of sort of, you know, these internet 24-year-olds types, and I don't know if they have the network yet to truly assess who they're dealing with. So I guess, so completely agree with Mark. It's a different world when you have sort of third-time entrepreneurs, you know, and sort of in the ecosystem and everyone knows, then you're seeing more and more of, which is kind of these, you know, people with really great product skills, et cetera, who don't really understand the funding landscape. And I think there's going to be in 5 years, like a kind of a lot of bodies on the field, and people are going to realize this stuff the hard way.
Okay. So last few things, anything that I missed that you wanted to talk about, and I'll start with Naval.
Anything you missed, come back to me. I got to parse that. I got to think about it.
Okay, we'll move on to Chris, and we'll come back to you.
No, I don't think so.
Mark?
So I'll do a good summary, which is just what Chris said. You know, it is hard for 24-year-olds with no network to know. So we've talked about some of the funds, First Round, Union Square, Foundry, GRP. So there probably are others, but those are the ones that come to mind. Everyone who's worked with Founder Collective that I know has said great things about them. You know, so you can get a lot of signals from a lot of people out there in the market. And what you should really be careful of is wolf in sheep's clothing. Look out for people who do a high volume of deals. And, you know, look out for people who look at this as purely an option. And that's probably a pretty good signal that it's purely an option.
Got it. Naval?
Yeah, I think the one thing that we didn't talk about that's kind of screwy and out there, and I'm seeing quite a bit, is when the VC fund doesn't invest in a company, but an individual partner from the fund invests in the company. And I never quite know what to make of that when one of those companies show up. So they'll say, you know, oh, the senior partner, you know, invests in the company, but his fund wouldn't let him invest in it. And I'm just never quite sure how to parse that one.
Got it. And I'll throw one thing in here, and maybe you guys will shit on my head, but as long as the entrepreneur knows what he's getting into, and maybe that's next to impossible, even especially for first-timers, I don't think it's that big a deal to take an option-style investment from a VC. And what I would suggest that they do, and I see this happening more and more, is take that option-style investment from 2, 3, 4, even 5 VCs, so the signaling value goes down tremendously.
Well, the signaling value gets diversified. If all 5 of them pass in your next round, you're screwed.
True. And like I said, as long as you know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Anyone want to take a shit on my head?
I mean, I think a lot of times I get responses to my blog posts like, well, that was my only choice. And if it's your only choice, it's your only choice. I mean, you know,
right.
What can I say? But I see a lot of cases where people actually do have choices, and they make this choice, and I think it's a mistake.
Great. Okay, fun question just to wrap things up. What's your favorite blog these days on any topic? And we'll start with Mark.
Ah, crap. You're going to start with me? Listen, the truth is I don't read 50 blogs. I don't have time. When you're a person who contributes a lot of content, it's harder to read.
Well, what do you read? What's the one you like?
I read Chris Dixon's blog. I read Venture Hacks. I read Brad Feld. I read Fred Wilson. And I read every post of every one of those people. I'm a parallel consumer. So, you know, I tend to on the weekend read 4 posts rather than necessarily read them as they come out. I sometimes like the snarky reporting at Silicon Valley Insider, Nick Carlson. Makes me laugh. I regret that ValleyWag went away, no matter how many people hate it. I kind of like a little bit of snarky reporting about what's going on in the industry. It's a bit of fun.
Yeah, me too. Naval?
A little not related to the industry, but right now I like reading PaleoNu, which is about the biochemistry behind evolutionary fitness. I like reading The Rawness, which is about sexual and social psychology. I like reading The Angry Economist, because it's Austrian economics in short little sentences.
Got it. Chris Dixon?
You know, it's funny. My behavior is completely shifted now where I get everything from Twitter. So I, like, constantly prune my Twitter list. But I do read. I read Mark. I think Mark's blog's phenomenal. I read Fred's, of course, you know, TechCrunch, Business Insider. But then everything, I'm getting so much more from Twitter and people retweeting stuff. And
I agreed with that, Chris. I'm noticing the same behavior pattern in myself.
Yeah,
okay.
I spend most of my time, frankly, pruning the people I follow, you know, or whatever.
That's exactly it. So the behavior that's different is RSS. I don't subscribe to as many things on RSS because I figure I'll see it on Twitter.
Exactly.
Honest to goodness, last question. We'll start with Naval. What's your favorite life hack these days?
Low carb. Changed my life.
Chris?
God, I don't know. Life hack? I'm trying to not have meetings, the maker schedule or whatever.
That's a good one.
Mark?
For me, it was getting rid of voicemail. I went over to PhoneTag where everything gets transcribed, and I read all my voicemails. It saved me an immeasurable amount of time.
Great. Okay, I think we're good. I think that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks.
All right.
Good. I enjoyed it. Thanks for setting that up, Nivi. It was fun.
If you've got a startup company hungry for seed money and you're looking for intros, or if you're an angel investor looking for an easier way to have hot prospects dropped into your lap, then you'll want to subscribe to AngelList. It's VentureHack's curated list of angel investors, and you can check it out at venturehacks.com/angelist. Plenty of other valuable news, interviews, and general advice to help your startup succeed at VentureHack, so be sure to poke around and check us out on Twitter as well. Until next time, for everyone at VentureHacks, thanks for listening. I'm talking about love.